Oh, you're too lazy to read the full title.
Tell us about fundamental properties and phenomenological aspects of loose quantum gravity.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll try to sketch at least the fundamental properties that loose quantum gravity has provided. But, of course, in this context, we are mostly interested in phenomenological applications. But there's no clear connection yet. So, of course, if one has a fundamental theory, it's always difficult to derive effects, especially effects that could be observable. And so what I'm going to talk about here is this missing link and the information we have so far to possibly fill it. But before I start with loop quantum gravity, I just motivate why we are at all looking at quantum gravity, given that the Planck scale is so tiny. So usually, especially in cosmology, one expects that the typical scales one is talking about are so large. Corrections due to quantum gravity where the Planck length appears are small based on this dimensional argument that just combining G and H bar, the speed of light possibly gives you such a small number. But sometimes dimensional arguments work, sometimes they don't. And a good example is just atomic physics, where you can also guess the Bohr radius just by dimensional arguments combining the fundamental constants involved. And that works quite well for hydrogen, so you get up to a number of order one the correct radius. But if you wanted to use dimensional arguments for heavy elements, there's a problem because you have a rather large dimensionless number, which is the central charge of the nucleus. And dimensional arguments don't tell you how it appears, so you don't know whether you multiply by that number, or divide by it, or take the square or square root. Depending on how you do it, you can produce any number, any radius. So that means at this stage, whenever there's these large dimensionless numbers, even, well, it's not too large, but any dimensionless number that's not of the order one, dimensional arguments can fail, and you need to use a theory, do calculations to see how these numbers actually appear in correction terms. In quantum gravity, we have this dimensional argument for a small length scale, but if something happens at this scale, for instance, discreteness, that this is the typical size of something like atoms of geometry that form space, then for a macroscopic region, we need a lot of these atoms, so that automatically brings in also a large dimensionless number in addition to a small scale. And we are in the same situation, maybe even worse, because the number is expected to be certainly larger than 100. So we have to do calculations and see how a number like this one or possibly other large dimensionless numbers appear in correction terms that come from quantum gravity. And if it appears in the right form, then correction terms might be larger than we expect based on these dimensional arguments. A second motivation, I don't need to spend much time on it after Paul's talk, is the Big Bang singularity. That's certainly a conceptual issue, and here, according to general relativity, the universe itself would have been very small, a point possibly, and zero is small compared to even the Planck length. So in this stage, we also expect quantum gravity to be significant and possibly provide a resolution of the Big Bang singularity. And loop quantum gravity has provided several models where this can be resolved, and I mention some of these models. Now about the missing link. Fundamental theories like quantum gravity start from very basic principles, which are not necessarily related to observational phenomena. For loop quantum gravity, the main principle is background independence, which can be realized. So that's one of the main successes of the theory, to provide a fundamental description of a quantum theory of gravity that is independent of a background. And even before we come to observations, there are many consistency issues which come up, which can be analyzed mathematically, and which help us in pinning down what exactly the theory should be. And then at some stage, if that is understood well enough, one would like to go further, derive phenomenological properties, and possibly relate this to observations that might be available. The consistency issue also, and especially the second one, is what is still to be completed for loop quantum gravity at a satisfactory level. But the tools are available. So typically, if you look at quantum field theory, the typical tools to get from a more fundamental theory to possible observations are often effective equations or effective actions in that context. And such equations are also available for loop quantum gravity and several of its models. And it's important, I think, to emphasize that effective equations are not just about providing some correction terms to classical equations. That's what they also do, because they need to provide the correct classical limits. So in certain regimes, they must reduce to classical equations plus corrections. But they can do much more. In particular, they can also tell us something about strong curvature regimes or strong quantum regimes in general, such as the Big Bang. So we can even apply effective equations to the singularity problem and then see more easily than using wave functions, for instance, what's happening. So this is really a link in this sense, because it's not just about phenomenology, but it links back to the consistency issues and the fundamental formulation. Now, for loop quantum gravity, the program is not complete. So although there are many results on the consistency, it hasn't been shown completely. But in the process of constructing the theory, several new effects have shown up at a more fundamental level, in particular the discreteness of spatial geometry that I'll mention in a few slides. And so that certainly deviates from classical general relativity, and then one expects that in some regimes there must be consequences. The question is how big they are, and that's where these effective equations come in, where we can take something like a fundamental Hamiltonian or a simplified version of it, possibly compute the effective equation that it implies and analyze these effective equations to see possible phenomena. Now, the particular quantization that's used is a canonical quantization, so we cannot use the standard tools of effective actions, but nevertheless, they are fully analogous versions of effective equations that can be derived, and which has been done now in several cases. So now about some more details of loop quantum gravity. The starting point is a reformulation of the usual way to view general relativity. It's formulated as a gauge theory. In this case, it's a canonical formulation, so we have a canonical pair of variables. And one of the fields determines spatial geometry just on spatial slices. So we use a foliation of space-time into constant time slices on which the spatial geometry is defined, and QAB is the spatial metric. In the end, there will be constrained equations which guarantee that everything is independent of the slicing, classically. And one of the major issues is to implement the constraints in such a way, also in the quantum theory, such that it, again, satisfies these consistency issues. So that even the quantum theory would be independent of the slicing. And so the spatial geometry associated with slices is one pair of the canonical variables, one half of the canonical pair. And the other half is the Ashtika connection A, which can be viewed as the related to the time derivative of the spatial geometry along this slicing. Now, these are the fields that have to be quantized. They have to become operators. And being a field theory, they are it's not straightforward. One needs to have some smearing. Usually one would integrate fields over three-dimensional regions using a background metric. So here we don't think we can use a background metric because the quantization should be background independent. So instead, we use a different smearing, which is geometrically more natural. It does not require a background metric. And the form of the fields basically tells us how that smearing can be done. The connection first can naturally be integrated over curves and then exponentiated. So these are this defined solonomies or parallel transport along a given curve, which might be open, doesn't need to be closed. And this field E, which is a densitized triad, can be integrated without a background metric over two-dimensional surfaces. So that is just like when we take the electric field in electrodynamics and integrate it to determine a flux, except for this additional index I here and the appearance of Pauli matrices, because everything is SU2 or SU3 as a gauge theory. It is geometrically an analogous quantity. And then it turns out that taking these objects, first of all, they form a well-defined algebra under Poisson brackets from these canonical relations. And this algebra can be represented on a Hilbert space in a rather simple way, which is even unique if we require diffeomorphism invariance. And this representation tells us basically that these solonomies will become some kind of creation operators of geometrical excitation. So that is analogous to these creation operators that we use in quantum field theory to construct particle states out of a vacuum. So here we can also start with a vacuum state which doesn't have any geometry excited, and then act with a couple of those operators, as shown here with different curves in space, and create a state which does have geometry excited in the sense that these fluxes have non-trivial, non-zero expectation values. There's some weak dependencies, I think, in the spectra, for instance. But you can view these as very local concepts, and you just take little pieces local. It's not really local, but you just take edges, curves, and surfaces in which are really contained in a single neighborhood of your topology. You might also take edges and curves which wind around in non-trivial ways, and that would be certainly topology dependent, but that doesn't matter too much for the representation you get. You have a question? Good. Okay. Okay, so this gives us a way, well, it basically defines the operator algebra, but it also gives us a way to construct all the states. So as I already mentioned, we start with some kind of ground state, the vacuum, where really not even geometry is excited. So it's not the vacuum that we talk about in quantum field theory. And then we act with these solonomy operators several times, and maybe even several times with a single one. And this way we can construct all possible states. All possible states of quantum geometry. And because the ground state here was so simple, it's just a constant, we can directly write down what these states are in the connection representation. Then these solonomies will just be multiplication operators. And here in this simplified version for U1 instead of SU2 for the rotation group, we have just a product of phase factors. It's unique if you require diffeomorphism invariance. So you want, because you have these fields defined on a spatial slice, and you want to have a unitary action of a diffeomorphism group if it really is diffeomorphism invariant in the end. And then this ground state is the unique state that is diffeomorphism invariant. So these I indicated that there's a uniqueness result of a unique representation of these operators, and this is based on this ground state. It's the usual thing. You have, if you have symmetries that you want to represent, and the diffeomorphism group is a large group of symmetries, then often you can derive uniqueness results of representations. And the same thing has been done recently, well, years ago, I think, in this context. But it's really a large Hilbert space, because you can choose all possible curves in space and create states in this way. Then, to see what this means geometrically, one can use these flux operators, which also come with the representation. They're based on the triad, which is conjugate to the connection, so they become functional derivatives. If one acts on these states, then the result, again, is rather simple. It's we just sum over all intersection points between the surface and all these curves that have been used in the state. And for each intersection point, there's a contribution given by this power here that's an integer, and also the intersection number between the curve and the edge. So everything is integer. There's a sum of integers, and that means the flux spectrum is discrete. So that is the discreteness result I mentioned. If we take this algebra that comes quite naturally, starting from these variables that we defined here, then the flux operators, which quantize the spatial geometry, automatically acquire discrete spectra. And that's one of the effects which occurs at this fundamental level, but being associated with discrete geometry, which is not realized in GR, of course, that's one of the things one would expect to have implications at some stage of phenomenological calculations. Yeah, here is also the more pictorial version of it, the way in which we can excite geometry. So a single curve, this yellow tube here, would represent a state which is not very highly excited. So we get areas only if we intersect it, which doesn't happen often if we pick random surfaces. And then this loop is really what represents the state in visual image. And the geometrical information is contained in the area that it endows for any surface that would intersect it. If there's no loop at all, then even if we pick an extended mathematical surface, it doesn't have any area because there's just no metric excited. These excitations come only from intersection points with curves in our state. And then there are these two different ways to excite it more. We can use the same curve and use these creation operators associated with the same curve. So we don't increase the number of intersection points, but we increase the excitation level of that curve, the geometrical excitation level. So given the same surface, we now would endow it with more area, because even though there's just a single intersection point, we have a higher excitation. And the second possibility, which is more useful than this one, is to use many creation operators associated with different curves. And then what we create is something like a dense mesh that represents this quantum space on those scales. And then if we pick a random surface, then it's quite likely that we have a lot of intersection points if it's macroscopic enough. And if the size of the surface is large compared to the typical distance between intersection points, then we are close to a continuum picture. Although if we go to smaller and smaller scales, then at some point we should see the discreteness. Now, this was all spatial geometry. So we just took our basic canonical fields, which were defined on these spatial slices. Then we have to make sure that this really is a spatial slicing which fits into a covariant spacetime. And that's where these constraints enter. There's one contribution that's most important. It's a Hamiltonian constraint, which, I don't have the classical expression. It's basically what's coming from Einstein's equation in this formulation. And the structure is just indicated here. V is an operator for volume, so that plays a role. And all these H factors, all these solanomies, so these are creation operators of geometry, which means that these all occur in the Hamiltonian. So if we use the Hamiltonian to determine dynamical states, some kind of evolutionary picture, then there will automatically be creations, creation operators, possibly also annihilation operators. But dynamically, the discrete structure that we have on a single spatial slice must change in time. So the discreteness might be refined if the universe is expanding. And then also each single loop that we have in the lattice might get more excited as time goes on. And so that's certainly a rather complicated picture. And the balance between all these different kinds of excitations combined with the expansion of the universe turns out to be quite important for the precise form of quantum correction. So that might be something that is at least constrainable by phenomenological arguments.
Is this still going on now?
Yes. So that would be now. So we have a large space, many discrete excitations. It's coming from a smaller spatial slice, which had less patches and possibly lower excitation numbers. If that's a valid picture, then it describes the whole space-time. So it must still be going on, and it must go on in the future. It probably was most important at high curvatures when you're close to these discrete scales at the Big Bang. But in a large universe, you don't expect individual corrections to be large, but you have lots of them because there are many discrete patches. And even if each of them gives you a very small correction, they could all add up and give you an effect even in a large universe, possibly dark energy. I'm not suggesting that it has been shown from loop quantum gravity, but it's at least a possibility that effects can show up in macroscopic regions. That might be unexpected, but there are examples for this. Brownian motion is a well-known example where you can see the effects of atoms hitting pollen grains, for instance, in a light microscope. That's orders of magnitudes larger than the size of atoms, but you still have a measurable effect. And that this was the thing that convinced physicists that there's really an atomic nature of matter. Now, before that, people didn't believe in atoms, so it was very surprising that a pollen grain should start moving and keep moving around. And then it was a very natural explanation that even worked out quantitatively that it's just being hit by atoms. Now, today, of course, we don't know what dark energy is. And it also looks like a large-scale effect, a macroscopic effect. But it might as well have a similar explanation. The universe might be accelerating just because we have all these little atoms of space that push it. And if they do it in the right way, if the dynamics of new quantum gravity, for instance, or another quantum theory of gravity turns out to be correct, then it might, in principle, provide an effect in a large universe. And yeah, if you do a precise calculation, it would... Oh, yeah, it's you have to parameterize it in a certain way. You could take the Hubble distance. It's well, the real quantity here is basically the patch density. So if you have a large universe, there are different ways because you can excite a single patch or you can create more patches. So there are different ways. That's what I mean by this balance that is important. Yeah. There are no calculations at all. It's just a suggestion that even in a large universe, there might be effects. And I think it would be more like a local effect here. It's not really determined by the Hubble scale. You could use the Hubble scale to parameterize it. It would be a convenient way to do it, but it's not done to be related directly to that scale. Yeah. Now we have a question. Okay.
Myself, like the ultimate cosmological observable, so will depend on volume, physical or physical, or but in both cases, unless I haven't have a specific calculation tell me what it was expecting, then I would have a basically a free parameter which I can tune, say the volume of the universe.
I'm not sure if you refer to this volume or whatever volume. This is.
I'm talking about the volume that will appear in past branches, say, from in this volume and
I don't think I have another slide later on if I get there, but I don't think it will appear. So maybe we should just wait and discuss that later. So given that picture and taking a few more details of what these Hamiltonians in new quantum gravity look like, there are three types of effects that we expect and which would all give rise to correction terms at some scale. The first one is very generic. It's just because it's a quantum theory, and whenever you do this, not in every case, but generically, you get new quantum degrees of freedom, quantum fluctuations, correlations, and infinitely many higher moments. They are all independent and they interact with expectation values. So that gives you the correction terms that one has, for instance, in an effective potential in effective actions. And the same thing will happen here in new quantum gravity. So that's one generic thing. But then there are also two very characteristic effects because based directly on our algebra, on these basic operators, because we didn't use the local fields, we used holonomies for the connection, and these are integrated, so these are non-local functions. They're also non-linear because we exponentiated. And so if this now appears in a Hamiltonian, such as the one I showed you, it has to provide certain correction terms, which might look like higher curvature corrections, for instance, or even non-local effects. So that is something one could in principle compute from a fundamental Hamiltonian, and one can do it in models so far, not the full situation. A second effect also relies on the basic algebra. It's a direct consequence of the discreteness of the metric. Whenever we write a Hamiltonian, it turns out we have to use the inverse metric, some inverse components, for instance, to contract the Riemann tensor fully to get the Ricci scalar. Now, in this quantization, the metric was represented by fluxes, and fluxes had discrete spectra. Zero was an eigenvalue. So this operator don't have direct inverses. It just doesn't exist as an operator on this representation. But nevertheless, they can be quantized in the sense that they are operators which produce the inverse in some classical limit, but differ from the inverse when we get to these small scales where the triad, for instance, would vanish. And so this gives rise to additional corrections, which are also quite characteristic for the way in which holonomies and fluxes appear in the fundamental Hamiltonian. And all these effects will show up in effective equations. So far, it hasn't been included in general because that would be a messy expression. But one can do these the derivation of effective equations and then also an analysis in several models, where, for instance, cosmological models. The main applications are, of course, to try to resolve the Big Bang singularity, and especially this second effect that I mentioned, holonomies, so far provide a rather generic repulsive force that acts in strong quantum gravity regimes and which can counteract the gravitational attraction, which is the reason why we have these singularities in the first place. And if that repulsive force is strong enough and it's not compensated by any of the other corrections that I mentioned, then it's a rather natural way to resolve the Big Bang singularity. And there are some models where that happens generically, but we haven't included all the corrections in all the models. So it's still, in general, an open issue. The second application will be to include inhomogeneities and then, the models where this has been shown are all homogeneous. So for cosmological observations, we have to see what these quantum effects mean for inhomogeneities, perturbative ones at least, and then possibly also try to evolve those through a singularity or through a bounds which might replace a singularity, and then use this for possible scenarios for structure formation. So these are the main applications, and they haven't been completed, but there are several results which are useful. And as I mentioned already, via these effective equations, we can really combine some fundamental properties of the Hamiltonians and even things like normalizations of states with phenomenological properties that at some point could be tested. And the main example where we really test very basic consistency issues is the reasonable cosmological perturbation theory, where we have to make sure that everything is generally covariant. So initially, because it's canonical, we have this time slicing, but the observables we compute should be independent of the slicing. And that is a strong consistency issue that can restrict possible correction terms or relate them and constrain free parameters. Now, here's a slide on the basic idea to derive effective equations in a canonical theory. So that's a simple example of an unharmonic oscillator. Effective equations are basically, the starting point is these are equations of motion for expectation values. So they're fully quantum. It might look like a classical equation. The first one looks exactly like the classical equation, but they are really quantum equations because it's exactly the information that the Schrödinger equation or Heisenberg equation, or whatever picture you use, gives us. The problem with a direct application is that you have, first of all, correction terms. That's not a problem. That's what we really want to have to test it. But this correction term, like here, involves a quantum fluctuation, which is itself dynamical, so it has its own equation of motion determined by the covariance between Q and P in this case. That has its own equation of motion, and if you go on, turns out that all infinitely many moments of a state are coupled to each other. And at this stage, effective equations enter, which are based on approximations of that infinite set of differential equations, which manage to decouple this to a finite set, or at least finitely many finite sets of coupled equations. And there are different techniques and different mathematical approximations with different physical meanings in which that can be done. If one goes through this procedure, one can exactly produce the low energy effective action as it shows up in particle physics. If one uses a semi-classical expansion in H bar combined with an adiabatic approximation for the moments. So these are the two approximations that decouple the equations in that case. And then one can solve it, compute this correction term exactly, and put it in the form of an action. That turns out to be the low energy effective action. So it gives us the same result in this case, but this one has the advantage that it's applicable to a canonical formulation, just like our canonical quantization of gravity. So it can also be applied there, provided we find a way to decouple the corresponding equations. In this case, if one looks at these equations, it turns out that the reason why this can be decoupled is the fact that it's just a perturbation on the harmonic oscillator. And for the harmonic oscillator, these equations automatically decouple to finite sets. So these two expectation values just couple to each other. Fluctuations and the covariance just couple to each other. That's a set of three equations, and also at higher orders, it continues to decouple. So, and typically, what we need is a solvable system of this form, which automatically does the decoupling, and then we can introduce perturbations such as this potential to see what's happening in more interesting cases where these equations do not exactly decouple, but we can at least decouple them approximately. So the main example is a harmonic oscillator, which is also used in quantum field theory because in the form of free theories on which we introduce interactions and then do all these usual perturbation analyses. Now, the harmonic oscillator doesn't really describe gravity or cosmology very well, but it turns out that there is a solvable system which also automatically decouples, very suitable for cosmology, and that's given by a spatially flat Friedman-Robertson-Walker model in which the only matter source term is a free massless scalar. It's not obvious that this is solvable, but it turns out to be solvable, and the solvability even persists at the loop quantization level. So it's even if we introduce these holonomies represented here by these exponentials, the model remains solvable. So even at this quantum level, the equations decouple to finite sets. So here's the definition with a single parameter to basically represent this refinement of the discrete size when we go to larger scales, which we don't know exactly. We can parameterize it at least. And the solvability of the model doesn't depend on the value of that parameter. So for each value, we get a linear algebra between these two operators. And if you formulate the Friedman equation in these variables for a free scalar and introduce the scalar as your time variable, you obtain this Hamiltonian, which is linear in the basic variables. So we have a basic set of operators which form a linear algebra of SL2R form, and a Hamiltonian that is linear in these basic variables. And just by doing algebra, looking at these equations of motion and the commutators I showed earlier, that implies that all these equations of motion that we have to use decouple to finitely many coupled equations. So that also represents A is a scale factor. Yeah. The variables. V is, it's not the scalar potential. It's just, I just use it as a variable. it's a certain power of the scale factor. Its momentum is related to a dot, so that would be the canonical variable. But we have to use this non-canonical set V and J to realize the system in linear form. Oh yes, yeah, that is, it's Friedman-Robertson Walker. It's even isotropic. So, but this will be the starting point, basically, for the perturbation analysis, and then you can introduce metro interactions or inhomogeneities perturbatively once you understood the system. So, here the equations decouple, and this can directly be seen if we write these the basic equations for expectation values. They decouple and they are linear, so that's easy to solve. We get two different solutions, a Cauchy solution and a Singh solution for V, which is related to the scale factor. If we just take these equations, we don't know which one is correct, but that's one example where these fundamental issues become important, even at this level of effective equations, because we have to make sure that the corresponding states that are used in these expectation values are properly normalized with a physical inner product. And it turns out that this Singh solution corresponds to states which would not be normalized, so it cannot be represented in a normalized way. We just solve these equations as differential equations, but we haven't made sure yet that any solution really corresponds to a state which was normalized. And if you look at it in more detail, you see that the Singh solution does not correspond to normalized states. The only solutions that come from normalized states are these Cauchy solutions, and they never become zero. So the scale factor never becomes zero. Well, the Cauchy, everybody knows what the Cauchy looks like. It has a minimum for V, so vertically it's V or the scale factor. Horizontally, it's this scalar phi. And in the solution, we can see that V never hits the bottom. It never becomes zero. So that's a representation for a bound. Really, in this exact quantum model, it represents a state. The mean is the expectation value. And then the spread is possible fluctuations, which also can be computed because we have equations of motion for them. And the solvability of the system even allows us to obtain dynamical coherent states. So that's a very highly controlled system. It's certainly quite special because it's solvable just like the harmonic oscillator. But nevertheless, it allows us to address some of the questions. We have the bound, so we can see what even this model could tell us possibly about the phase of this model universe before the bounds. In particular, as we saw in the picture, the fluctuations don't need to be exactly the same. So question of potential interest is how strongly we can constrain the fluctuations before the bounds, given some semi-classicality assumptions after the bounds. And probably also more general properties of what the state before the bounds could have been. The model is very special. So if I don't think anybody would be surprised if the statement would be that if we have a certain amount of fluctuations now, then before the bounds, we would have had the same level. After all, for the harmonic oscillator, that's basically what's happening. States don't spread. But I think an interesting point here about this model is that even though it is very controlled, we have dynamical coherent states in a precise form, we are not able to say a lot about fluctuations. And the reason is that the ratio of fluctuations before and after the bounds, which is this delta plus by delta minus here, is it's very sensitive to initial values. So if we have a nearly symmetric state which doesn't spread, we would expect this ratio to be near 1, so that should be 0. But the actual ratio, depending on initial values, which I denote by A here, and H is the matter content, depends in a characteristic way on the initial value and on the matter content. So These are different curves depending on the value of H, and the larger H is, the more matter we have in the universe, the more macroscopic the universe becomes, the steeper this curve is. So for a universe which has a lot of matter in this model system, of course, we have a very steep curve, so it's very difficult to pinpoint what ratio of pre-bound to post-bound fluctuations we have, given a certain value of initial values, which we might not know precisely. So if we wanted to produce a very symmetric state, we would have to use a very large fine-tuning in the initial values. So even in such a highly controlled model, we are not able to make very strong statements about these fluctuations. It's just the quantum fluctuation of the scale factor or something corresponding, some observer quantity corresponding to it. So here I'm not talking about any perturbations to the model. It's still the exact model, but we're looking at different states in different dynamical coherent states for that model. So my next point is about, it's still isotropic, but now I'm including matter interactions. And then we don't have an exactly solvable model, but we can introduce the potential perturbatively, just like we introduce interactions in particle physics by perturbations around free theories. And then these equations for expectation values, they do couple to quantum variables, to fluctuations and correlations, and all this can be summarized in such an effective Friedmann equation. And all terms can be, I don't have formulas for all the terms for eta, for instance, which represents correlations, but they all represent, they have an expression in terms of series of quantum variables, and also depending on energy density and pressure P. So that is an equation which in this general form is valid to all orders in this perturbation theory. And we first look at the simple cases where either correlations vanish, so eta would vanish, or we have a stiff fluid, rho equals p, then the second line is just zero. That corresponds to our solvable model, where we have the free scalar is rho equals p. So we just have the top line, and this equation shows immediately that there's a bounce, because this rho critical is a given number, Planck density, for instance. And when energy density becomes Planckian, this 1 minus rho by rho critical is 0, and we get a 0 for A dot. So that provides a bounce. And it's really always a bounce in this case. It's not a recollapse, where also A dot would be 0. So in this case, independently of what quantum fluctuations do, independently of what our state really looks like at the Big Bang, the universe has to bound. It cannot reach arbitrarily small scales. The question is only, what happens if we do have interactions and these two extra terms here come in? Then we'll have to know more precisely how large these correlations are when Planckian densities are reached. So in this case, it's more difficult to reach a general firm conclusion about the bounds, but nevertheless, the statement is quite strong because it's only quantum correlations that matter, only eta, and there's no fluctuation term in eta that follows from the detail calculations. So if we do have a matter potential, but no correlations, but possibly very strong quantum fluctuations, then we still just have the upper line. So in this case, the quantum state, the universe would still bounce, even though it reaches a very highly quantum regime. So there are statements of this type which are quite strong, which can be made, but there are also still open questions because it's difficult to see what this correlation, for instance, would be at Planckian densities, especially because we have to evolve for long times if we want to guess what the state could have been like at the Big Bang based on some properties that it might have now. So this is the situation about isotropic models and the bounds. And in the remaining minutes, I'll talk about what can be done so far about including inhomogeneities. So that's certainly a crucial step to develop a cosmological perturbation theory which works in this context and which can include quantum effects. Now, in this isotropic model that I showed, the main correction is coming from holonomies, and this is really the dominant correction unless we have a really strong quantum state. In inhomogeneous situations, the situation is not so clear because we have the subdivision, and the subdivision possible refinements affect the parameters and the correction terms differently. So I don't have much time left. I won't spend too much on these more technical details. But the crucial parameter that shows up here is, again, the patch density. So n, as earlier, is the number of discrete patches in a given volume, any volume, and v naught is the size of the volume. So the ratio doesn't depend on the volume. And also observables based on these corrections won't depend on the size of the volume we choose. But it's rather the density that determines the density of these discrete patches that determines the size of quantum corrections. And so just to give an idea, if we are near this scale A star, where inverse metric corrections become significant, then we are basically talking about a universe that has one patch per Planck cube. So that is certainly something that's not unexpected. And then we have certain regimes in which we expect classical behavior. Now, because these regimes are different, it's an upper limit for curvature and a lower limit for the scale factor, but both C star and A star increase with n. So that means if we increase n, we affect the limits differently, and that's the reason why different correction terms are affected differently if we introduce this refinement. That's also a technical remark for some people here, depending on which papers you read. Sometimes there's a reference to gauge artifacts, which is this V-naught dependence, but there are no gauge artifacts at all if you put in the precise behavior of that parameter, and that basically cancels the V-naught dependence. So that's also more technical. There are different models that have been studied so far, corresponding to different values which determine the refinement. But now I come to maybe more interesting cosmological results. We don't really have any strong predictions so far, but one can still use the correction term that we get in certain effective equations and just put in these parameters like the vertex density and try to see what observations would give us if we don't put in the assumption that it could only be Planckian vertex density. And to me, at least, it looks quite surprising, because even if we don't put in that we expect Planckian vertex densities or patch densities, if we just take observations, and the example so far was Big Bang nuclear synthesis, put in some correction terms, match this parameter that enters through the correction from new quantum gravity, just the observations, consistency with Big Bang nuclear synthesis tells us that the patch density cannot be higher than 3 discrete patches per Planck cube. It's, by itself, that result is not surprising. It's basically what common sense would tell us. But I think it's already a strong indication that not using common sense, but just putting in observational bounds gives us an upper limit of a similar size. And the correction terms used here were corrections in the Hamiltonians of radiation and fermions. So if you change them too strongly, you basically mess up Big Bang nuclear synthesis. And because that also changes the expansion rate during nuclear synthesis. Yeah. Yeah, so we put in these correction terms. We take everything else basically as it is in standard Big Bang nuclear synthesis. And then these correction terms are consistent only if this bound is satisfied. So it's not yet a very strong bound, but I think if other observations are used or some observations become stronger, these bounds might become more interesting. And recently, this unpublished work about tensor modes, which also acquire correction terms. And also here, the indication is that first of all, there could be an enhancement depending on these quantum corrections. And the precise enhancement depends on this parameter x, which in a rough way corresponds to the refinement of the discrete structure as the universe expands. Well, it has been done for tensor modes, so for scalar modes are more difficult to derive, but if something similar holds there, then that's also seems to be a strong indication that we could put experimental observational bounds on these parameters, which play a very fundamental role in new quantum gravity about the underlying discreteness, but nevertheless, they can be constrained in some ways. Oh, they did Kolonomi corrections. In which sense consistent?
In the sense that if rho critical is some constant, then it's populated at early times, so it gets something which is
not positive. So, for rho? Rho is not positive.
The half of that.
Well, also here, if you just take values of rho larger than rho critical, it's not positive.
No, suppose I take x
not but why? You're solving an equation of motion for A. It's a differential equation. Yeah. So you might get the bounds on larger scales. But you're not going to enter the regime where A dot would be imaginary. Well, that depends on the parameters.
Yes,
okay. Yeah.
Are
you saying that? Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. You can rule out some parameters. And that would be one possibility to rule out extreme cases, possibly. But it doesn't rule out the whole range. And you're never going to fix a single parameter to an exact value by using such consistency arguments or observations or whatever. So you might have a range near minus 1/2, and that's what things seem to indicate. But you're never getting it exactly minus 1/2. And the precise value, again, depends on the balance, how we excite these states and how the refinement happens. So we can get a handle on it from two sides. There are these observational things, there are fundamental considerations for how the refinement should actually happen based on a fundamental Hamiltonian. And so far, we don't have full control, certainly, so there are still several values that are allowed, ranges of parameters. But as the analysis goes on, certainly these windows will shrink. And it's just the usual thing. And I think what you call inconsistency is really an observational conflict in some cases. So it's good that we can already rule out some cases, but it's not enough to pinpoint everything to a single value. Yeah, I'll try to finish this off quickly. So now we have to use these basically these states, discrete states, inhomogeneous states, to define something like cosmological perturbations around an isotropic one, an isotropic state, and then in particular make sure that the equations we get for these perturbations are consistent in the sense that they can really be formulated for gauge invariant quantities. It's of course we have this effective Friedmann equation, so one can could use it as a modified background equation and put the usual classical perturbation theory on it. But typically that doesn't work. It's I think it has been tried in many cases in all possible versions of classical or quantum field theories or on classical or quantum modified backgrounds. But because you need to refer to the background equation to show consistency of the perturbation equations, usually it doesn't work if you just modify one, just the background, not the perturbation equations. So one has to rederive all the perturbation equations based on an analysis of these inhomogeneous perturbations and make sure that the consistency is satisfied. Also, this relates to fundamental consistency because it's really the constrained algebra which must be of an appropriate form to ensure that everything is independent of the slicing that we chose in the first place. Also, to get to an effective description or semi-classical description, we have to choose a state, and that might not always be easy to choose precisely in such a way that we have consistency, so they also conditions on the state. And all this can be computed at the effective level, so the state is parameterized, the algebra can be computed, and just like one would compute an interacting vacuum with corrections in quantum field theory, we can compute dynamical Korean states based on these effective equations that describe the growth of inhomogeneities in an expanding universe. So that is not fully complete yet, but we do have some equations for tensor modes, but these are some of the equations that earlier remarks were based on about tensor modes. And I just wanted to show this example here because it already tells us how the consistency issue enters and how it can be done by effective equations. Here, I'm considering a correction for inverse powers of the triad. So that is the form of the Hamiltonian. It determines cosmological perturbation equations for the tensor mode with some corrections depending on alpha. Should just be one classically. And given that equation, we can derive the dispersion relation for gravitational waves. And it turns out to have a frequency larger than wave number. So that might look like it's superluminal, but at this point, we still have to consider the consistency issue. Well, they travel faster than the classical speed of light. What's happening is that also electromagnetic waves carry similar corrections. So the physical speed of light also is corrected. It might be larger than the classical value. And if you implement consistency to make sure you have this correct constrained algebra, it turns out that this alpha squared that we have there and this dispersion relation has to equal the correction factor in the electromagnetic radiation. So there's no superluminal motion, but this can only be seen once these consistency issues are implemented. So that's another example where we can use effective equations. It's all done at the effective level, but we still get indications of fundamental properties of how these Hamiltonians have to be corrected. And all this analysis is still ongoing. We are just finishing scalar mode equations, which are more complicated, in particular concerning gauge issues, but I think they should be available quite soon. And this opens up a lot more applications. So far, we had only quite weak indications, rather weak bounds, but with scalar modes, one could go through the whole structure formation scenario starting very early and possibly even see how these all these modes travel through the bounds and check what kind of implication this has. But this is still a missing link, so we still have to complete these perturbation equations and also the analysis, but at least it can be done. I mean, it's calculations have to be finished, but we do have a consistent way to start with fundamental properties of Hamiltonians, which are restricted by some consistency conditions of our underlying theories, and then derive effective equations and use those for applications. So the main application so far has been the singularity issue in isotropic models, and I reviewed the status of that question, and there are some equations already available for cosmological perturbations. Some of them have been applied, but this process is still ongoing. So we are deriving these equations, and applications are also basically just starting. So I'll stop here, and thank you for your attention. So I assume your phantom has to be active really also on large scales, when not just on small scales, right? Yeah. So right. So you have some. So it's like these superinflationary solutions. So you get a big rip, and the big rip is resolved by the other quantum effect on large scales, I assume.
Turn around on the other end.
Yeah.
Again, because if we were just doing this non-logically, you have a minus sign on the Freeman equation, and as energy begins to get large on both ends, you turn, you go back the other way.
Yeah.
So we're using that minus sign based on large energy density on both ends. So I'm wondering if you could
And we still have trouble getting significant quantum effects on for large scale factors.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, but then you have to put in the phantom. We don't get the phantom from these equations. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. If you say okay. Yeah.
So we needed two things.
Somebody did it with these equations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, when it's in my hand.
But not in isotropic models. But there's a... Yeah, there's a Chinese group, right? But it's and you need to get these correlations under control, because if you're evolving for long times, so if you're getting into a high energy density regime, these correlations might also grow. So in this context, it's not so clear. If you just take the upper line and phantom, you get what you described. But if you take the complete effective equation, you have to get these ADA under control. So it's not so clear from this perspective what's happening. Yeah, but yeah. Well, yeah, if the state remains uncorrelated at these times, we can make a precise statement, but we don't know which states remain uncorrelated at these times, starting from initial values now. Depends on A star. And A star, N depends on the volume. V naught is the volume. But the volume dependence just cancels out. It's just the patch density. The density. The density, yeah, that's okay. That's a parameter that we restrict in this Big Bang synthesis. I don't have it. Right? So it will be an additional parameter that you can fit. It will appear in observables, which is good. So you can get a handle on the number, the refinement model.
Yeah, but even what I'm saying is that you have any calculator, one can say that a priori this model will be compatible with W5.
Well, it will put some constraints. If you don't put in any additional assumption, it could be anything from zero to infinity, and certainly some constraints on this range will be put by any observation you use.
Yes, but the problem might be the equation here is that now, it's so good that you have freedom in tuning your parameters, so that you will keep the bay. Observe the point. So, I'm just trying to, understand what would be a test to really constrain this, would really rule out or not this model. My feeling is that WMF or Planck wouldn't be able to rule out.
Well, I think you can only rule it out if you combine observational analyses with fundamental considerations, which would tell you that, for instance, this refinement can happen only in a special way. And maybe you have to have a certain number, a certain value for the patch density. If you just put in this number, certainly you can always make it very close to what you have classically. But if you put in additional theoretical input from your fundamental theory, you can see if these parameters can be achieved that you need to have for consistency with observations. And in this way, you could rule out the theory. I mean, it's always, you need additional theoretical input to rule out the theory.
So, your analysis is supposed to work,
themselves. But my question is, from a more fundamental point, what is this, how would you imagine this scale to emerge?
No. Well, in this model we have it, and we use it, but we don't need to. And they're effective. You can do this effective formulation for constraints. Arthur is working on it, where you don't deparameterize. So you should just take effective constraint equation, do a constraint analysis, and you can do this without using phi or any other internal time. So it's yeah. Mm-hmm. It's not an easy problem. And you have areas and volumes and
right,
length,
so
but they even. Yeah.
Done it.